thousand years.
KSDP, 8:30 a.m. in Sandpoint. K201DA, 88.1 FM in King Cove. KOLD, 91.9 FM in Cold Bay. KFPS, 88.1 FM in Falls Pass. And KKQA, 88.1 FM in Accutan, Alaska.
I'm a paleo nerd. I'm a paleo nerd. I'm a paleo nerd. Don't you understand? I'm a paleo nerd.
Hey, Dave.
Hey, Ray, you beat me to it.
Yeah, Dave, I did. So how you doing, man?
I'm doing good. I am considering a dog. Today is the day I actually consider it.
What?
Well, yeah, I've seen this dog twice. He's it's a species or breed. I've never heard a species. I guess it's dog.
Canis, too much paleo nerding for you.
What is it? Canis familiaris?
Something like that. Yeah. Doggy.
Yeah, it's called a McNab Shepherd.
Oh, so you're going for a purebred, not a rescue dog?
No. He's totally a rescue dog in a shelter that was going to be put down. He's a year and 7 months old. I haven't made the commitment yet. It is a 10-15 year commitment.
Easily, and do you get to like test drive the dog? Do you go for a walk and hang out?
Yeah, I've hung out with the dog twice already, and super super smart. This breed is a breed from Northern California.
What?
Yeah, of all places in the world. He looks kind of like an Australian cattle dog, Labrador, Shepherd mix.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, and super, super smart.
Are they bred to be friendly?
Yes, they're bred to be herding dogs, really. So that means they're smart. Okay. And so I just have to literally, today's the day I turn that switch and make that commitment. So I'll let you know next week when you hear the barking in the background. But that's beside the point. But I have a...
Yeah, what's the point? What is the point? Well,
it has totally unrelated.
Okay.
Now, you've heard of the Burke Museum, haven't you?
I have, indeed.
And do you know what's happening at the Burke Museum right this very moment?
Well, my show is continuing
there.
That's
right.
Maybe today's the day it's down. I don't know.
There's a Ray Troll show there, but the Burke Museum...
In Seattle, Washington.
That's right. That they have just completed a field season in Montana, Hell Creek, and they found some awesome, awesome specimens of... Do you know what an occipital condyle is?
I know the name. No, I guess the short answer.
Oh, it's that huge ball joint, like on the back of a pickup truck, the back of the frill of a triceratops to hold that massive head and gives the massive head the ability to swing.
Yeah, like a,
it's a ball
it's
joint.
Like a, yeah.
And these things are grapefruit sizes and cannonball size. Well, they actually found a triceratops skull. They found the hips and legs of a duck-billed dinosaur. A hadrosaur, and they found the chicken from hell, which is, it's a species of Anzu wiley.
Right. That's the chicken from hell. It's a type of really big
theropod. Yeah, an ostrich-like theropod. Anyway, they're jacketing all this stuff up, and they're going to be shipping it for the fossil preparatory viewing area in
The Burke Museum. That's cool.
So, having never been there or having never heard of the Burke Museum till I met you, there you go.
Well,
there's some news.
It is Seattle's premier natural history museum.
Well,
I gotta go
when I'm up there next.
Yeah. No, it's a great museum, and it's really been fun. I've had 3 exhibits there.
Awesome.
Over the years.
Yeah, awesome. Well, you should. You're a Pacific Northwesterner.
Well, my career got a real start there. And you know, our buddy, our mutual pal, Kirk Johnson, now at the Smithsonian.
I've never heard you mention that guy.
Yeah, right. We shamelessly name drop him all the time.
No, you name drop him on every episode, Ray.
Well, Kirk grew up at the Burke Museum, basically. His mom used to drop him off there. So, yeah.
That's a good mom.
Yeah, it's a good mom.
So wait, we have an amazing, amazing guest today. And not only is he just one of those people who totally, you can tell, loves paleontology, but he has a pretty amazing YouTube presence. Many, many interviews of his work. And we talked about his book, Locked in time by?
By, well, Dean Lomax.
Dr.
Dean Lomax, that's right. And many of our guests are PhDs, but not all of them. But Dean got, he went kind of an interesting route. We'll ask him about that, how he got his PhD. But
yeah, he sold his Star Wars set. To pay for a trip.
Well, that led to, one thing led to another, but he's got a really interesting background. What's cool is that my geologic timescale is in the new book. He wrote me an email out of the blue saying, hey, can I use this in my new book and or my upcoming book? And now the book is out.
Yeah.
And it is called Locked in Time. We'll ask about that.
Yeah, yeah. It's a great
book.
Really
excited. The guy is a true, I think he's a bona fide
paleo nerd. Oh, you can tell. You can tell. Yeah. And we're going to dive down into his first love, which is what?
Ichthyosaurs?
Yes, sir. Marine reptiles. Yeah. The marine.
I want to nerd out because I'm sort of an ichthyosaur.
Me too.
As well. And I've personally helped find a few. So I'm excited to talk to him about that.
And,
in Southeast Alaska.
By the way, Ray, your sclerotic ring is showing.
I had surgery on that.
Yeah.
It's back.
Oh, yeah. Okay. So let's...
I have mine enlarged, Dave.
Now, he's all the way across the pond, and let's give him a ring, shall we? And I'll use my English phone, if you don't
know. Yeah, let's call him up. He's in jolly old England. He is our first guest in the UK.
Okay.
Give him a dial, man.
In the UK.
I see what you did there. Hey, Dave, meet Dean Lomax, paleontologist, author, adventurer, and science communicator, and visiting scientist at the University of Manchester. Dean, it is great to finally meet you, man.
Oh, it's a real pleasure to finally meet you, Ray, and you too, David. It's an honor to be here.
Well, thank you. Yeah, before this interview, you guys were part of the Mutual Admiration Society.
Yeah.
Dean, where did you first come across Ray's work or reaching out to Ray?
Well, that would be in 2008. I saw his poster, which, funnily enough, I literally have on my wall right in front of me as we're speaking now. His poster from the Cruising the Fossil Freeway book.
You were 18 then, right? In 2008?
Yeah, 2008. Yep, 18. So I was at the Wyoming Dinosaur Center, which is kind of part of my backstory of how I get into paleontology.
Yeah.
I'll come to that in a moment. But yeah, I was walking through the gift shop there, and of course I bought his book.
Good man.
But one of our mutual friends, Bill Wall, he had said, oh, you know, Dean, I'm in this book as well, and he's like, oh, there's this cool poster, which they have up in the gift shop. So I went and I was like, oh, I stood there for literally what seemed like hours and hours, and I'm sure it probably was hours.
Wow.
And now I get to do it all the time. Literally, it's right in front of me.
I've got some artwork of his behind me right now there.
Yeah, I'm all over the place.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I like that, you know, Banksy did the thing, exit through the gift shop, and so I'm glad to be represented. You met me in the gift shop. That is so cool. And but yeah, I think Dave has got a very important question for you.
Yeah, real important, and sure, I know the answer. Dean, are you a paleo nerd?
Oh, well, I absolutely am a massive paleo nerd. In fact, I'm wearing a Hallucigenia, stylized Hallucigenia t-shirt right now just to prove how much of a paleo nerd I am. You can even see its smiley little face.
And we all know that Hallucigenia is a Burgess shale organism that literally looks like something out of an Owsley acid trip.
Yeah, man. Hence the name. It's Cambrian beast. And what's so cool about it is for years they looked at it and they realized that they've been looking at it upside down. And then they looked it the other way. But hey, Dean, how did you come to your paleo nerddom? You were one of those kind of semi-annoying kids that knew every polysyllabic Latin name of everything and always recited them. And did it start with Jurassic Park in your generation or what? How did it start?
Yeah, I would say one of those very annoying kids. So I was that kid in school who every opportunity would be taking in dinosaur toys, taking in fossils to talk about. And it was just kind of everything I could learn about. It had to be something related to prehistoric life. And so growing up, I'm originally from Doncaster, a town in Yorkshire, in South Yorkshire. And so kind of growing up, that was all I ever wanted to be, was a paleontologist. And so I collected fossils, read as many books as possible, and eventually kind of got to the point of looking at university. But in school, you know, I wasn't the best student in school. In fact, you probably won't believe this, but I actually failed science in high school. I failed.
Well, it's not hard to do if you have a poor teacher that doesn't incite the interest.
This is true. Yeah, this is true. There was one teacher who I do remember. I mean, some science teachers at the school I do recall were, you know, were good teachers. But one of them in particular, when I was like, oh, you know, I want to be a paleontologist, he literally said to me, huh, you'll never be a paleontologist.
What?
And, oh, yeah, seriously. No. Seriously, at like the age of maybe 12 or 13. And I can imagine for a kid that age, I was, it's kind of shocking.
Dream
and
so destroyer.
It always stuck with me.
It's crushing.
Yeah,
crushing.
Right, exactly. Yeah, exactly. So, you know, for coming from a town in Doncaster, which at the time was not really well known for fossils, and I'd always visit sort of the Yorkshire coast. I don't know if you're familiar with the sort of geography of the UK, but I'm from like a couple of hours away from the Yorkshire coast. So I actually grew up visiting the Yorkshire coast to collect fossils from places like Whitby. Maybe you're familiar with that. And in fact, actually, literally in my little cabinet of curiosities behind me, I have a cool fossil of...
Now, what sediment and age is the Yorkshire coast?
Yeah, the Yorkshire coast material, David. So that's Jurassic, early Jurassic material.
But marine?
Yeah, marine. So about 180 million years old. So I'm holding up a... So this is a really big nodule. It doesn't look like anything. But this is the sort of stuff that we'd collect. So we'd go out looking for these kind of circular nodules. And getting your eye in, having a bit of experience in the field, and you're kind of like, you know, I think there may be a fossil in there. Crack it open, and then you've got the ammonite.
Oh, my goodness.
Beautiful ammonite.
Look
That's
at that.
That's what we're looking at there, yeah. Wow, cool.
Hold on. I need to do a screenshot real quick here, so hold that up there. Okay, yeah, that's awesome.
So you got to go fossil finding as a kid, so you really had the fever. And as I understand it, so you had the bad grades, you did not have the best teachers, people were telling you, stop playing with the dinosaurs, grow up, get a job, man. So you got the job, and at 18, you did something extraordinary. You sold a certain collection, and you went off to the US of A.
Yeah.
And that took guts. Yeah. That took real guts to do
so
that.
So tell us that story. What happened there?
Yeah, well, just to go back slightly from you asked your question, right, and answer about sort of Jurassic Park and getting into paleo. So Jurassic Park, funnily enough, it really wasn't one of the movies, at least from my early childhood memories, that kind of sparked my imagination. Because with Jurassic Park coming out in 1993, I was, 4 years old when that came out, and so I don't think my parents would let me see it. So I was more like kind of Land Before Time, right? So Land Before Time, which is an excellent movie, but that eventually, as I got a little bit older, Jurassic Park, of course, was such a cool film, cool movie, and so watching lots of documentaries, Attenborough documentaries on fossils and things like that, you know, that kind of really did spark my imagination, as well as getting out in the field and visiting museums and reading books. But then when I got to my kind of teen years, and touching upon what you just said there, when I got to kind of the age of, I guess here in the UK, probably 15, 16, it was still very apparent that I wanted to be a paleontologist no matter what. And so I looked at all the possibilities here in the UK, but because I didn't have the grades, you know, I'd failed science in high school, kind of my top grades, I've been reading up a little bit. I think it's what you call is it AP examinations in the US?
Yeah.
AP for college entrance. That's right. Yeah. But my grades for that were ridiculously poor, like so bad. Yeah, there was no way I could get into college, into university here. And so the other option I had was to go and look at the prospects of gaining some sort of proper first-hand experience. And so I looked at literally going to the, it takes a bit for me to say this, going to the USA. So this is, I'm 18 in 2008, and I had to continue working a whole bunch of jobs that I really, really didn't like. So it's in bartending, in delivery, and also, you know, I come from quite a poor sort of family background. So I had to raise as much money as I could to go on this trip to Wyoming. And I landed on this museum called the Wyoming Dinosaur Center, but I needed the money to get there. And I didn't have enough, and so it kind of still kills me to say it. I see you both laughing here, but
not me.
I sold my childhood Star Wars collection of action figures.
Oh man!
And did the deal. So, yeah, and then off you went.
Yeah, pretty much. I ended up selling for Transformers fans as well. I ended up buying kind of Transformers toys from like the 1980s. I was a big Transformers fan. I used to buy them from like car boots, which are like flea markets. And I used to buy them from there too. So I sold them as well. So yeah, primarily the Star Wars, but Transformers. But hey, it funded that trip to Wyoming. And that is really where my career began. It set me down the path that I went into paleontology.
But that took guts and it took passion and it took dedication. So yeah, I laughed about it because it's sad in a way, but
it is.
But it is absolutely brilliant that you took those steps for a life-changing opportunity.
Thank you.
And what blows my mind is you wrote to these fellows, the folks at the Wyoming Dinosaur Center, right? And you said, I'm coming over. Can I go on a dig? Will you? What about housing? What about, how'd you arrange all that? They just showed up?
Yeah, so with that, so I was coming right to the end of my final school year, which over here we call A-level. So it's like the final year, year 13, so I'm 17, 18 years old. And there was, by chance, there was actually a substitute teacher who, he was a really good teacher. And we got chatting about, he was like, Dean, what are you going to do when you leave school? And I said, look, I want to be a paleontologist. I've been getting as much experience as I could here in the UK by volunteering here and there, collecting fossils. And he said, well, where in the world would you like to go? And I was like, oh, you know, this Wyoming would be amazing, Montana, somewhere like that. You know, go on an actual proper dinosaur dig, a full-scale excavation. And so he wrote to a couple of these places as well for me. He was really nice, a really great guy. Wow. And I've kept in touch with him over the years. And so I basically wrote out kind of a CV of myself, what I've got here, and a kind of introduction to my background and what I'd like to achieve. And we had a few places come back, but the Wyoming Dinosaur Center, it stuck out like immediately. They basically said they were fantastic, and I've kept in touch with them over the years. Brilliant institution. And they said to me, you know, Dean, we'd like to give you an opportunity to come and volunteer here for almost 4 months. And as long as you can pay for your airfare and pay for your time over here, we'd be willing to put you up free of accommodation.
Wow.
as part of their they had interns there for the summer, and so they said that you can go and, you know, share with the intern house. And I was like, what an opportunity, of course. So it was my first time being around professional paleontologists and also students. So there was so many questions that you imagine, right, in high school, me being that kind of, well, being that paleo nerd, right, being that dinosaur fanatic, chatting about these things. And most of my friends who, they were very kind to me, expressed an interest, but it was kind of next level being in Wyoming at the Dinosaur Center. So I could actually talk about hallucigenia or anything else, and people got what I was saying. I kind of found a place, if you like. And by going out there, it just opened my eyes to the world of paleontology and how the field itself, how it works in the field. So how you can become a sort of field scientist, become an academic, go into public engagement, work in museums as a curator. And it kind of gave me a real taste, a real flavor of how to approach it as a science. And so spending that 4 months there just really gave me so much experience. It really became the backbone of my career.
Wow.
You are a shining example of how you put your nose to the grindstone. You can achieve anything you want.
Well, it's having that dedication to that vision. You wanted to be a paleontologist.
Yeah, that's it. So after all of the 4 months spent in Wyoming, I came back to my hometown, to Doncaster, and I'd always visited my local museum, which is Doncaster Museum and Art Gallery, as a child, but they never had any fossils on display. So I'd always been under the assumption that they didn't have a fossil collection. As it turns out, when I'd approached them and said, look, I've just come back from this dig in Wyoming, and I met with one of the head archaeologists there, Peter Robinson. And Peter said, oh, you know, Dean, we actually do have a few fossils here in the collection, but we haven't had a paleontologist since, I think it was 1912.
Oh, wow.
So it was quite some time ago, And the last geologist, she'd retired in the 1980s. So I just said, well, look, you know, maybe I could volunteer here, and with the money that I was earning from like the jobs bartending and stuff, I could just continue to pay like bus fare and stuff to get into the museum, just to gain that experience, to see the bigger picture of gaining as much experience as possible, because that could help in the future. And so anyway, between the two of us, we said, yeah, you know, Dean, come in to volunteer at the museum as and when you can. And as part of that, you know, looking at the museum collections, we can create a mini exhibition, mini display on the fossils that you kind of rediscover. Well, going through the collection, it became very, very apparent that they had no idea of what they had.
Wow.
And so I'm going through like, yeah, so you imagine, right,
oh,
as a paleontologist,
or
up-and-coming paleontologist, going through like drawer after drawer and thinking like, oh,
what?
I have no idea what that is. And then like pulling out like Eurypterids, like literally over a meter and a half long. Yeah, and they have no clue what they had. And so looking at this stuff, it turns out altogether, we managed to find about Well, over 10,000 fossils. And they
what?
Yeah, and they over 10,000, and they.
And would these have all been collected in the last century or the 1800s?
Yeah, so they were all collected. Yeah, over the course of the museum sort of being built, which was 18, I forget their date when it was opened, but yeah, over the last 100 plus years that they were collected, and some of them purchased, and so it was kind of just like me going through this kind of hidden collection, and as an 18-year-old, and obviously then I spent several years going through the collections. Earning so much of my time, obviously learning so much of my time over in Wyoming, and putting those kind of that experience to the task at the museum, going through the drawers, identifying so much material, being able to handle all this stuff, because obviously I've been handling fossils since I was a little boy. You know, I'd been collecting them, and so I had a basic understanding of identification, so I could say, this is an ammonite from the Yorkshire coast. This is a fossil plant from the Yorkshire coal measures from deep underground in the coal seams. But then one cool thing happened is, one of many cool things at the museum, but one of the education managers at the time said to me, "Dean, you and Peter are putting together this exhibition on fossils, and we actually have a very cool plastic copy of an ichthyosaur."
Ah.
And so I was like, "Oh, neat. Let me go and take a look." And so he and I, we walked to the back of the museum, went into the little education department, and he whips off this sheet. And underneath the sheet is this ichthyosaur staring at me. And my immediate thought is, well, that's not a cast. That's not a replica. That's a real specimen.
Yeah, it was not a cast.
Yeah, exactly. And I say this to him. I was like, this is real, right? And he's like... Yeah. It can't be. We use this in education sessions with children.
We roll it around in the schools all the time, and the kids are pounding on it.
pretty much. So we immediately stopped that from happening.
Using it.
Had it cleaned up a little bit, and literally from that day, right between the ribs of this ichthyosaur, and I should say this ichthyosaur is about 1.5 meters in length, maybe a little
That's
bit
a
longer.
Big,
it's a really beautiful. Yeah, it is, and it's a beautifully preserved. You've got the skull was preserved, almost complete skull to almost the tip of the snout. Then you've got parts of ribs, parts of one of the forefins, and some of the vertebral column. And then right between the ribs is this dark mass, which I remember thinking right at the time when I saw it, I thought, well, that's really weird. I wondered, could it be stomach contents or something like that? And then, as it turns out, because this is how serendipitous paleontology is and how things kind of fall into place, that summer that I'd just gone to been in Wyoming, I happened to meet Professor Judy Massere, who is a renowned marine reptiles expert, primarily working on ichthyosaurs. And so I had that contact. So I sent her some pictures, sent Bill Wall some pictures, and the two of them said, this looks like stomach contents. A few other people had also said the same thing. And so Judy actually encouraged me to write that up as a scientific paper. And of course, I thought, wow, I can't do that. I'm 18. And there's no way I could do that. I have no clue what even a paper was, because, and funny enough, it's probably make you both laugh. But in Wyoming, because I'd never been brought up with that academic kind of background, when I heard the students or the paleontologists say, "Hey, have you read that latest paper on T-Rex or this?" I genuinely thought they meant newspapers.
I got to confess, Dina, being an artist, I didn't know about papers. Really, until I started hanging out, with scientists, that's what they do. They write a paper.
Yeah.
But, for our listening audience, I'm thinking about those who are tuning in or maybe hearing this out of the blue. Can you tell us, can you describe what an ichthyosaur is? Because, we're nerds. We know what they are. But what's an ichthyosaur?
It's not a dinosaur.
Well,
if I had a pound for every time you said it's not a dinosaur, I'd be...
You'd be very rich.
Yeah.
So first of all, definitely, David, they're not dinosaurs. So ichthyosaurs are these incredible group of extinct marine reptiles. So they superficially look a little bit like dolphins or sharks, and they lived exclusively in the water as well. And they evolved roughly, around about 250 million years ago. And they evolved this dolphin-shaped body, although some of them actually look quite a bit more like whales. And in fact, they grew to the size. Some of them grew to the size of whales.
Shonosaurus. Is the largest one.
Yeah, one of the largest. There's a research paper I brought out a couple of years ago which indicates some of them may have even got bigger than that. So possibly up to the maximum size of blue whales of 30-plus meters
in length. What? That big?
Yeah, massive. So they were doing what what ichthyosaurs were doing, what kind of, what whales, dolphins, and that have been, you know, doing now. Ichthyosaurs did it all long
before. They did
before,
it all so long before, yeah. So when we say, you say 30 meters, that's approaching 100 feet in...
90 feet.
90 feet-ish. Yeah.
Okay, back to the ichthyosaur. So they started in the early or mid-Triassic 242 million years ago, but they died out 10 million before the KPG Cretaceous extinction.
They made
event.
It toward the end of the Cretaceous, yeah.
But yeah, but why did they not... What happened 10 million years before the KPG boundary? Why? Why then?
Many theories.
Yeah, it's weird, right? Yeah, there's many theories. And it was a little bit before then, so it's roughly about 90 million years. So a little bit earlier than 10 million. But they,
30 million years before. Yeah,
yeah, but about 30 million years. But it seems such a mystery, because if you look at marine reptiles, if you look at extinct marine reptiles, and you think of, you know, plesiosaurs, pliosaurs, you think of mosasaurs, some of the ancient crocodile relatives as well, you know, the marine crocs, of them all, and even today, with even marine iguanas, sea snakes, or even sea turtles, ichthyosaurs are the best adapted reptiles for the ocean. So you'd imagine, like, why would they go extinct? They evolved this fish-shaped body. They're so, you know, amazing predators. Some of them are super quick, and it seems so odd. But the kind of two main theories are that, one, for a long time, there was the fact that ichthyosaurs may have been sort of out-competed into extinction by sort of more... modern type sharks or things like mosasaurs. But then that, although it's probable, that it also doesn't kind of add up in the whole grand scheme of things. And one of the big research pushes of late, over the last 10 years, looking at ichthyosaurs and the extinction, one of the key things is that potentially it was even due to climate change. So differences in climate change ultimately drove ichthyosaurs, if not ichthyosaurs themselves, there was a certain prey that they were feeding on, couldn't adapt quick enough to that environment, so therefore they died, and then the food chain died, so the ichthyosaurs died too. And then other animals like the sharks and the mosasaurs clearly must have been doing something better than the ichthyosaurs, and so very sadly went extinct.
Yeah, it's kind of an interesting concept, and that the mosasaurs and other marine reptiles outcompeting them, you know, is pretty much the standard story you hear, but it's kind of an idea that, like, the pool was getting overcrowded in a way, but but just...
But I have a habit of steering our guests, Ray, toward not completing a thought, and we got to go back to that fossil you found.
Let's go back to that. And I have a habit, too.
Yeah, so what's that,
too,
Ray?
And I want to follow up on this question, but let's go back to finishing up that story.
This is not ideal, because I do this too. Once you get me talking about
fossils...
Yeah, I know.
We can talk for hours.
It's our downfall. We veer here and veer... left and right, Dean, but it's the nature of...
So the black mass you saw in the rib cage of your 1.5-meter ichthyosaur...
Ichthyosaur, yep. So this turns out to be its last meal before it died. And so literally preserved between this dense black mass are hundreds of microscopic hook-shaped objects that are from the arms of squid. And then on top of that, we found... at least just one isolated, sort of like a centimeter sized fish scale in there as well. So we know that roughly 187 million years ago, when this ichthyosaur was swimming around the Jurassic seas, it was feeding on squid and fish before it died, which may well have been sort of a lazy Sunday afternoon.
Right.
It was full, you know, it was full of its last meal and it died. And so for me, that kind of blew my mind a bit. I was like, oh, how cool is this? And so speaking to Judy Misere about it, Judy had said, you know, Dean, nobody had written up a study of an ichthyosaur from the early Jurassic with stomach contents in the UK for a number of years. And so she'd encouraged me to get into writing the paper, which I began writing when I was 18, almost immediately following the trip to Wyoming and my first couple of weeks volunteering at Doncaster Museum. And so that led me into ichthyosaurs, and ultimately staying on that theme, I know we can get into more about ichthyosaurs in a little while as well, but staying on that theme, so I actually teamed up with Judy Misere in 2010, and our plan was to go through and look at the historic ichthyosaur genus, which is Ichthyosaurus, which gives its name to the group. Yeah, and that's what, as it turns out, the ichthyosaur at Doncaster was an Ichthyosaurus, but I couldn't quite work out what species it was. And as a result, the species, the genus itself wasn't that well defined, so you couldn't say, you know, look at the skeleton and say, oh, it's, you know, X species or it's Y species. And so for doing that, me and Judy said, let's team up, and using Judy's experience and kind of my passion and drive and excitement to get into the field, we teamed up and became, you know, we've become great friends over the years, And we spent for years and years and years literally traveling across the UK, across the US, and in Europe, examining thousands and thousands of ichthyosaurs, primarily Ichthyosaurus. But in doing so, the specimen at Doncaster, we determined that it was a new species to science, and wow. which we got to name. And this is one of five ichthyosaurs that I've named as new species. But this one still gives me goosebumps talking about it, actually, because it meant so much to me for multiple reasons, because it was my hometown, because the way in which it was initially thought to be a plaster copy. Yeah. But we decided to name it after Mary Anning.
She sells seashells, doesn't she?
Apparently so.
And ichthyosaur skulls, too.
Yeah.
So it's Ichthyosaurus Anningae?
Yeah, correct. Yeah, Ichthyosaurus Anningae. And amazingly, you know, despite Mary being the first person to bring ichthyosaurs, her discoveries were the first ichthyosaurs brought to the attention of science, nobody named an ichthyosaur after her.
Really?
So it was the first time that anybody named an ichthyosaur after it, formally as an academic, you know, peer-reviewed.
Dean, have you seen my book, Planet Ocean? You ever seen that one?
I can't say I have, unfortunately. Sorry, Ray.
In that one, I did a drawing, and we'll put this on the website. This is great because I get to go back through my vaults. I did a drawing of Mary and the ichthyosaurs, and she's laying on the cliffs of Dover, and there are ichthyosaurs above her. So this is like perfect, and it's giving me goosebumps just thinking about it right now, man.
Wow.
But so, Dee, tell me, after you published the paper on the ichthyosaur, you went back into academia somehow, or you earned a PhD?
Yeah, so after the time in Wyoming and after doing the research on the Ichthyosaurus Anningae, at that time, so this is 2014, 2015, I'd written quite a few papers at this point. And so I became affiliated in January 2013 with the University of Manchester here as a visiting scientist, where I had sort of my own students to work with as an expert on ichthyosaurs. And at that time, because I'd never did an undergrad degree, we looked at the prospects of doing a PhD kind of right off the bat based on my experience.
Oh.
And yeah, so I decided I'll do a master's, what we call over here an MPhil. I think you may have an equivalent in the US, but effectively an MPhil is kind of like a higher master's. So it's between a master's and a PhD, and often it's your first year of a PhD. So I did the MPhil, and then again, based on the research that I'd had published here and other works as well, other books and things, I'd kind of worked my way up and worked so hard to get to a point to be able to actually study for a PhD. So despite never having an undergrad degree, I managed to do my PhD, which I completed in 3 years. Wow. And it was funded as well, incredibly so. It was funded to do that work. And as part of the PhD, I did it by publication. So this traditional route is where you do one single thesis, or there's another route where you can do it by publication. And so as I continued to do my research, I had to have like a running theme, which inevitably was ichthyosaurs, and specifically a revision of Ichthyosaurus. And as I published, they became chapters in my PhD. So every chapter in my PhD I published. And so by the end of the PhD, I think it was 7 chapters was published. Wow. And that became my thesis. And became,
you leapfrogged into a doctorate.
Yeah, leapfrogged into doctorate, and then became, doctor, elevated to Dr. Lomax.
Well, doctor, that is a cool story. It's a very inspiring story, man. Very cool. This is a perfect opportunity to turn the conversation toward your amazing book, Locked in Time, because you have taken this idea of these frozen moments, these literally fossilized time, the little episodes, and expanded it into an extraordinary book.
Can I say that of all the things in paleontology, this is the thing that makes my hair stand on, what little hair I have left stand on the back of my neck, because it's the moments in time that make it real for me, you know? As you said, a dusty old bone in situ is boring, but when you find an organism locked in a Tuesday at 3 p.m., and you see that was a living, breathing organism, it is mind-blowing. And that is what your book, Locked in Time, encapsulates. So do explain to our listeners how you got the idea and what it is. And then we're going to talk about many of these chapters.
We have a long list of all the stuff, so we'll see how we go. So Dean, what's it all about, man?
Yeah, Locked in Time, I have to, again, first of all, the trip I had to Wyoming in 2008 really did define me very much so as the kind of the backbone of my career for multiple reasons, but it's also where the idea behind Locked in Time came from. So the very first day I visited the museum, there was another volunteer called Jordi, who was from Spain, and Jordi gave me a tour of the museum. He'd been there for about a month or so before me, before I arrived. He gave me a tour of the museum, and he stopped me at one spot, and he showed me this big chunk of limestone, and I looked at it, and he said, "What do you think's unusual about this limestone block?" And there was some... The only way I could describe it is that they're in the middle of this massive limestone block, which is... It was probably about 2 meters tall. There's this like this area which looked like trampling or some sort of footprints. And he said to me, "Dean, follow that, and it gets bigger. This limestone block gets bigger and bigger." And I was like, "Oh, I'm kind of puzzled by this." So I start to follow this sort of trampling, and then immediately you can see that they're footprints. And there's footprints leading away from this kind of trampled surface. And this limestone block continues to grow and grow and grow. And right at the end of this trackway is the animal literally dead in its tracks. You've got this little horseshoe crab, which is...
That's my favorite one. That's my favorite one in the whole book.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, it's you can see why. This literally is my favorite for multiple reasons. But I remember seeing it. And it blew my mind. How could that happen? How could you have this little horseshoe crab from 150 million years ago? This is from the Solnhofen limestones in Germany, which is famous for the fossils like Archaeopteryx. This little horseshoe crab's fallen into what was a hypersaline lagoon environment. So this is where there's no oxygen there at the bottom of this lagoon. And literally you have preserved where it's landed on its back on the prosoma. It's wriggled around. It's righted itself, and then it's left its little footprints, its little tracks in time, where then it's, I mean, it's very sad.
It was sad.
Then it's
so
suffocated.
Sad,
it's
but
suffocated.
He's disoriented, isn't he? He's a
yeah,
bit disoriented.
Yeah, right, yeah, exactly. So it's disoriented, and it's kind of rocking, you know, it's walking up and down, and then it's changing direction. And then right towards the end of the track, you can see where its legs are getting sort of deeper in the sediment where it's trying to push off.
I'm laughing.
It's terrible. Terrible, isn't it?
Ray, stop it.
It's trying to push off of the sediment, and then, you know, eventually it succumbs and it suffocates to death, which is, you know, it's dreadful. It's a dreadful story. But then for the paleontologists coming along 150 million years later, that encapsulates such an epic fossil. To have that preserved, you've got the entire thing. You've got, it's very rare, as you I'm sure you both well know, to have a trace fossil preserved with a body fossil. But to have that entire moment in time preserved, and also I think it's very cool, these types of fossils are called Morticnians, which is effectively death traces.
It's an ichno fossil with death in the end.
Yeah, exactly that. And that was coined by a famous German paleontologist, geologist called Adolf Seilacher, who sadly is no longer with us. He was a fantastic scientist. And he's described these types
what
of fossils.
What is that word again? I'm sorry.
It's Morticnian.
Morticnian.
So it sounds like death and ichno?
Yeah, like death trace.
Death trace.
Oh, my goodness.
Now, how do you know, you're assuming the ocean was anoxic without oxygen, and that's why it died, but couldn't it have suffered something at the surface, and then, you know, a bird pecked its inner carapace or something, and then it died. But I mean, is the assumption that it's anoxic, or is there a chemical analysis that shows that?
Yes, so the area of Solnhofen is, they're effectively a bunch of lagoons, of what Solnhofen was. So you've got what's called like the Tethys Sea, which is where all the animals were living. And then during storms or potentially like tsunamis, or potentially, like you say, it could be a bird or a pterosaur or something has predated on an animal and it's dropped it in the lagoon. So practically all the fossils that you see from Solnhofen are these ancient lagoons, which are anoxic at the very bottom. So no oxygen at all, and there's nothing effectively living in the bottom, at least in most of the lagoons. So let's say, for example, our understanding of this specimen, this horseshoe crab, is that almost certainly there was some sort of storm event that happened. And there's evidence of storms, if you study the Solnhofen limestones, that some sort of storm event had happened, flung this little juvenile into the lagoon. And in fact, if you look at modern-day horseshoe crabs, in fact, as part of the study, because I went on to describe that horseshoe crab in 2012... So not only did it give me the idea to for this book, but I was so fascinated by it, I ended up describing it with a fellow paleontologist who was at the Wyoming Dinosaur Center at the time, Chris Racy. And he and I looked at the literature, looked at modern horseshoe crabs, And based on inexperience with their behaviors of modern horseshoe crabs, as juveniles, if they're ever spooked in the water column, they tend to swim up. So there's more chance if there's a storm, they're going to get caught and flung out of the sea, so, and hence happens.
So it did not die of old age or boredom or anything. It was a juvenile, right?
So, sadly not. So this is a little one.
So it was a dark and stormy night, and the baby gets cast. It gets even sadder. Oh, my goodness.
You know, it does. It is quite sad. You know, you're dealing with death constantly as a paleontologist. you know, I actually found myself telling this story recently as part of a talk, and it was a general audience, and I'm talking about this little horseshoe crab sort of suffocating to death, and you've got, at the end of this, there's a little kid that raised his hands, he was about 5, and he said, oh, what happened to the horseshoe crab then? And his dad was like, well, he suffocated to death, son. I was like, well, you know, from the perspective of science and communicating that, it makes for a great fossil, a great story, and it was one of those kind of funny, amusing moments where everybody in the audience was kind of like, this is hilarious, but also at the same time, tragically sad for the horseshoe crab.
We have to give a shout out to Bob Nichols.
Bob did an incredible job. Bob is the artist that you work with. How was that? What was the relationship like there? How did you guys go back and forth there?
Well, he's a funny guy. I watched that video where you guys were interviewed by the Natural History Museum. And his responses were very funny. He's a unique guy. Bob Nichols.
He does the incredible illustrations for Locked in Time. And my only lament, though, is that it's not in full glorious color, man. I'm sure.
What is your favorite illustration in the book? Because I have mine, and I'll tell you what mine is.
Oh, there's so many. There's just so many great images. But, you know.
Mine is the windswept colony of pterosaurs. And there's some of them are many of them are flying, but some of them are sitting on the beach in a driving rain.
That's pretty, he's good with that.
It looks like they're almost sitting out, looking out over, pondering the storm.
And I like the Tetacosaurus mama with all the little babies. But hey,
yeah.
Dean, what was it like? How did you guys, what was it like working with Bob?
Yeah, so as I said, I had this idea for such a long time. I wanted to bring together a book about amazing fossils that tell actual stories of behavior. So Dave touched upon the fact that these are the fossils that really grip you, right? You kind of feel some connection to them. They're not just kind of inanimate objects. You know, as cool as a dinosaur bone is, if you have some sort of real story to tell, you can actually take that story and kind of relay that on to sort of modern day world. So you can see, you know, obviously as humans, we have similar behaviors. We have our pets. You can see wildlife today. You can watch a documentary. You can see animals today behaving in certain ways. And so to be able to translate that back to fossils is quite remarkable. And so I wanted to find somebody who I know, who is not only a very talented artist, but Bob Nichols is a great scientist as well in his own right. And so I approached Bob, probably must be about maybe 4 or 5 years ago. And I'd known Bob for a couple of years prior to that. He and I had met at a conference here in the UK. And so we were good friends. And when I approached Bob with the idea, he was like, dude, what an awesome concept for a book. And he couldn't think of any other book that had this approach before, where you're literally looking at the direct evidence. And that's one of the things, if I say so myself, hopefully I don't sound arrogant saying it, but you know, that's one of the things I've always loved about this idea, is that when I came up with this concept, I really did look far and wide to see if there's anything quite like this, which is based on the direct evidence. So we couldn't find anything. And Bob was so captivated by this idea that he was like, yeah, let's bring this to life. And he was keen to not only bring the fossil itself, but to then bring my text to life. So I was kind of writing the text for, say, the horseshoe crab. So then sending photos of the fossil and the text to Bob and saying, like, Bob, this is kind of what I have in mind for the reconstruction. And so for every single image in there that he created, every single piece of illustration that he created, including the front cover, so 51 new artworks for the book.
Wow, that's a lot. Yeah.
He is a lot of work, and every single one is, and this is why I find it so unique, every single piece of artwork in there is based on evidence that we have contained in the fossils. And it's some of the stuff when he sent to me, one of my personal favorites, funnily enough, is the Cetacosaurus, this famous babysitter specimen. It's just, it captures so much. And And it, later in the book, there is a... This is one of those cool like Easter egg type things where in the book, if you skip to the fighting, biting, and feeding chapter, right, there's one where we talk about one of the mammals that fed on dinosaurs. In the background there, you've got that Psittacosaurus babysitter.
Oh.
So I don't know if you've caught on that. Yeah. So, he was keen to do things like that. But working with Bob, he's such a talented artist and scientist. And so having his background and input, because I also ask him to, when he's kind of reading my text, I'd say, Bob, let me know if you think we could tweak this or if I could say something better here. And sometimes he'd come back and be like, you know what, Dean, maybe we could slightly change this so that we can reflect the image slightly better, you know, so his reconstruction. And so everything that I was sending to him, he was obviously then kind of translating in his own mind, turning it around and thinking, yeah, what's the best story we could tell given the exact evidence that we have contained in the fossil as well as Dean's text. And I think, you know, it's been a pleasure working with him and seeing it literally, the idea and these fossils brought to life from Bob has been, yeah, it's been fantastic.
Well, they really bring a sense of a moment in time. Ray, what is your favorite locked in time moment?
Oh, Dave, there are so many locked in time moments here. I've got a whole list of them. I went through them this morning, but I'm sitting here in Kansas and I'm realizing that I am within striking distance of many of these fossil finds. And Dean, there's Ashfall, which I could drive to tomorrow and be there. And Ashfall is so cool. But then there's also the Dueling Mammoths. There is Snow.
Oh, yeah. Oh my God, the Dueling Mammoths.
Let's tell the Dueling Mammoths story, because there's a kind of a little punchline at the end of that that I love. What happened there, man?
Yeah, that is actually, funnily enough, I can thank you for that kind of, Ray, because the first time I came across the reference to that was on your poster, literally on the poster staring at me right now.
Right there,
so you've got the Clash of the Titans in there. I'd never heard of that fossil before. And so that was the first time having some idea of that, so 2008. And then always having that in the back of my mind, I was like, what a cool fossil. So you have here two big bull Colombian mammoths that were literally found fighting to the death. And these are about 12,000 years old. They were found in Nebraska. And when they were discovered, the team that were working together, they were literally excavating the skeleton. And they found, when they got to the tusk, they found that the tusks were tangled. And they didn't understand what was happening. They thought, maybe it's one of the tusks broken. And is it kind of like clipped around, kind of caught on the other tusk? And then they continued to excavate. And they found that these two mammoths were actually stuck together by their tusks. And the reason why is because one mammoth had a broken left tusk and the other mammoth has a broken right tusk. And so what had happened is they'd managed to get in so close. Have you ever seen African elephants kind of butting heads and, you know, they clash their tusks? In this instance, these massive mammoths with obviously long curved tusks, the one that was broken either side, it meant that they could literally connect together, and then they didn't, when they're trying to pull away, they just couldn't do that. And so they got stuck. And so potentially what had happened is then one of them, it may well be that one of the mammoths perhaps died first, so then the other one is literally stuck to it. It couldn't get free.
Wow. And one of the tusks poked when it was in the orbital the eye socket.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so one of the complete tusks of one of the mammoths is,
do you know how painful that must be to have a mammoth tusk in your eye?
Extremely, extremely painful.
Don't they find some deer with these, their horns are connected and stuck, and then you find...
Yeah. They do.
Yeah.
Yep, they do. And in some cases with deer and elk, once the fight is over, it may well be that the loser loses their head as well. I've seen images of where you've had elk trying to escape. Yeah, rip them off. So for a mammoth that you've got two mammoths, you imagine these animals at probably, 10 tons. There's no way really it's going to be able to do that after such a big fight. Plus, they were in the environment they were in, looking at the geology, it was quite a slippery sediment. And so you can imagine this mammoth trying to get up and keep falling down.
Oh, man.
And so to have that, have this incredible fossil preserved together, which, as I should say as well, it was 1962 when they were found. And it's one of these specimens that not so many people have heard about.
Right.
And so reading about this, you'd probably be surprised to learn as well, it's still not formally been described.
Really?
There was a... Really, yeah. I was kind of... I'm kind of keen to do that. But I need to get out and physically get there and see it and work with some mammoth experts. But it's...
A couple of things about it. It was Kirk Johnson. I've mentioned his name before in this show.
I met Kirk.
It was Kirk Johnson who mentioned it, who told me about it. And I've yet to see the fossils themselves. But I wanted to say that this is basically a case of fossilized toxic masculinity in...
Where is this fossil?
It's in Nebraska. Which collection is it in, Dean?
It's at the Trailside Museum.
All right. But I think the kicker to the whole thing is that when the mammoths died, they apparently fell over and they squished a coyote.
A coyote.
The coyote, yeah. That was, yeah, sitting there. Yeah. They found the coyote underneath. I mean, it literally is like, yeah, fossilized... You know, Wile E. Coyote right there.
That's even yeah, more tragic.
I know, and it fell on the poor little
coyote. Poor little doggy.
I know. And that's such a spectacular fossil. But hey,
really is.
Dave, how about you? What's one of your favorite stories in this, besides the sad little horseshoe crab?
Well, the horseshoe crab really made me feel sad. I mean, that kind of took the cake. I would have to say the Megatherium burrows were pretty astounding. The South American burrows that are a massive tunnels with the scrape marks from the Megatherium claws. And did you say that there was, what's that word?
Morticnian
was a Megatherium found in one of the burrows or no?
It was actually, yeah, it was. So that wouldn't be defined as a Morticnian. So the Morticnian has to be kind of a direct trace, sort of left behind, and it's kind of dead in its tracks. With the ground sloths, so yeah, I mean, these are giant, sort of elephant-sized ground sloths. These are massive animals, and they're creating these enormous burrows. They literally burrowed underground. Some of them were, I think, the largest on record, extended over 100 meters long. So they were burrowing way into these tunnels and living underground.
You could drive a car into these.
Yeah, you can. Yeah, they're that big. You know, you could easily drive a car. You could walk into these, no problem. And you've got inside some of them. Not only do you have the bones of some of these ground sloths preserved inside them, but as you just mentioned, you have the claw marks on the sides as well. So you can match up the claw marks with the claws of the ground sloths to show without a doubt that they were made by ground sloths whose fossils are found in exactly the same area.
Yeah.
That is so cool.
Speaking of matching, I saw a YouTube video of you walking through Steve Etch's museum.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
And you both talked about ichthyosaur bones that were crunched by pliosaur mouths. Is that correct?
Yeah.
So the triangular shaped teeth literally fit the smashed up crunched bones of ichthyosaur pelvic girdles and rib bones.
Yeah, that's exactly it. So that's, yeah, Steve Etcher, the in Kimmeridge in Dorset here, so the Etcher's Museum. So Steve and I have known him for now probably about 10 years, and he's a fantastic, talented paleontologist. He was originally a plumber, and he collected an incredible amount of fossils from this one area called Kimmeridge Bay. In Dorset on the Jurassic Coast, and that's on the south coast here in the UK. And he amassed so much material over the years that literally some of this stuff, well, most of this stuff is better than anybody has got in collections of the same age here in the UK. Incredible stuff. And it's all roughly about 150 million years old. And he and I, in this little video, we were going through his collection looking at sort of some of his fossils that tell stories of behavior. And you have ichthyosaur remains and pliosaur remains, quite literally, with bite marks matching the kind of triangular-shaped tips of the tooth crowns of pliosaurs. So again, you can play kind of dino... Well, not necessarily dinosaur in this case, but dino detective.
Marine reptile detective.
Yeah, tell the expert. We're a marine reptile detective here, and you can work out exactly that they were these animals were feeding on the ichthyosaurs and other pliosaurs just by the teeth.
But this is locked in time moments. This,
yeah, yeah.
We'll have this link on.
Yeah,
our,
it's a cool video.
Yeah.
So you know, Dean, one of the most classic fossil behavior moments is the Velociraptor versus Protoceratops. Mm. And I was,
yeah, cover of the
I'd
book.
Always thought that that, yep, had happened in, that Roy Chapman Andrews had discovered that, but it's been known about for, it seems so long, but that only happened in like 1971. Can you describe that classic fossil to us?
Yeah, so that was found during an expedition to the Gobi Desert by a Polish and Mongolian team. While searching for dinosaur fossils, for dinosaur eggs, they came across this, well, two skeletons, two practically complete skeletons, literally found fighting to their death. So you have Protoceratops in one corner, which is this earlier relative of Triceratops.
Ceratopsian.
It didn't have the big brow horns, but it had a frill on its neck, and it definitely fits into that family. It's quite a smaller body, about the size of, say, maybe like a boar. So the boar-sized Protoceratops. In the other corner, you have Velociraptor, which is the size of a turkey, and you've got these not human size, size of a turkey, and you've got these fighting together, and it to this day is still one of the best fossils, in my opinion, up there in the top five best fossils ever discovered anywhere in the world. And this, it's a national treasure in Mongolia, and quite rightly so. It just captures, again, that moment in time of these two animals locked in combat, where you've got the Protoceratops has got the, I think it's the right arm of the Velociraptor.
In its mouth.
Yeah, clamped down.
Like, just below the elbow. Get off me!
Yeah, right. And then the Velociraptor, which is kind of laying on its side, has got its infamous killing claw on its left leg held up really high, and that's in the throat of the throat region of the Protoceratops. And that is just like, can you imagine? What's the chance of that preserving in the fossil record? It's incredible. So to have these types of fossils, they just tell so much about these animals in life. You can learn so much more.
We know how they got preserved. Tell the story of how really the only way these two creatures would have died mid-fight.
Yeah, so there were a whole bunch of theories, and people have kind of gone backwards and forwards on them. But the best is that a sand dune collapsed above the pair. Perhaps it was triggered by, say, heavy rains from a thunderstorm. And whilst they're in sort of mid-fight, this sandstorm has just triggered the sand dune to collapse, and it's just, boom, covered them over. And then that's it, preserved.
If you've ever been in a sand dune, you are immovable. You cannot move once you're surrounded by
this
sand.
Right.
I've played in the sand dunes in Yuma, Arizona.
Wow.
Yeah. So it's just a spectacular fossil. And to kind of epitomize the book and talking about behavior in prehistoric animals, it just had to be on the cover. And that was the reason why when me and Bob were talking about it, we was like, dude, if we're going to pick a fossil, it has to be that one. It's a very iconic fossil, too.
I saw it at the Natural History Museum in New York, the American Museum of Natural History.
Oh, did you? Did you? Oh, that's
so. Did they loan the actual pair? It was the actual, wasn't a cast, it was the real deal?
This would have been in 2000. So it was a traveling exhibition. I would assume it's the real one. But if I was Mongolia, yeah, I'd say it was real, but send an incredible reproduction.
Now, the classic fight that we all know, the ultimate one, is T-Rex versus Triceratops. And there is perhaps, it's not been totally published yet or really thoroughly studied.
Is this the fighting dinosaurs or the dueling dinosaurs?
There is, and they are out in, is it North Carolina?
Yeah, they are now, yeah.
Which ones is which?
So you've got the fighting dinosaurs.
Are the Protoceratops.
Yeah, Protoceratops and Velociraptor. And then the dueling dinosaurs are what's possibly a juvenile Rex with possibly maybe a Triceratops.
What childhood classic is that?
Yeah, right?
T-Rex and Triceratops.
Hopefully we'll get that crew on the show sometime. But I want to ask you about SI.
Oh, what? Yeah.
SI, what? Say again? Is something interesting.
Smithsonian Institute.
No. SI means something
Science
else.
Science investigator.
It means something else to our guest today, Mr. Strassman. Dean has something interesting to talk about.
Indeed. So SI is one of the most, if not the most famous sites at the Wyoming Dinosaur Center. And when they were exploring the local area, so before the Wyoming Dinosaur Center became a thing in the late 90s, I think it was, or mid-90s, they were exploring the area. They knew it was famous for Morrison Formation fossils, so you could find dinosaurs like Allosaurus, Diplodocus, Camarasaurus. Whilst exploring, they came across this one site where you had bones of a sauropod, which turned out to be Camarasaurus, other bones of another sauropod, which was a Apatosaurus, and then loads of teeth of Allosaurus. And throughout that area, it was quite different to the usual kind of matrix that you get of the like the mudstoney type matrix of the Morrison
Formation. Just Jurassic?
Yeah, so this is late Jurassic Morrison Formation, again, around about 150, 155 million years ago. And they found this kind of really weird formation, which it turns out that it was where dinosaurs, specifically sauropods and some theropods, had been leaving their footprints in this kind of muddy region at the side of a lake. And after the museum was built and as they continued to excavate this site, which became known as Something Interesting simply because it was something interesting.
Very original, yeah.
Yeah. And I was lucky enough to excavate there 2008, 9, 12, and 2019 most recently. And over the years, they'd exposed this partial skeleton of a Camarasaurus, but it was, for want of a better term, it was ripped apart. This partial skeleton